But the mortgage worked the hardest and the steadiest of us all. It worked on nights and Sundays. It worked each holiday. It settled down among us and it never went away. The farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down. The farmer is the man who fixed it all.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Down on the Farm with Tom Willie, your monthly wireless program where you get to visit with outstanding figures in the world of food and agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley, working hard to better the quality of the land and better the quality of the food that you eat. My guest this evening is a little farther afield. We just established, looking at a map a little while ago, that she's kind of on the fringes of this Central Valley, and you'll learn she's from Vacaville, the town of the cows, I assume is that's what it means. My guest is Alexis Kofod, and she is from Vacaville, and until recently was very, very busy, along with her husband, running Soul Food Farms, raising lots of eggs and pastured poultry for many customers in the San Francisco Bay Area. Alexis, welcome this afternoon.
Hello.
And thank you so much. You drove all the way down here from lovely Vacaville to Madera, the town of the lumber town. And first of all, I'd like to ask you, I always ask my guests, Alexis, are they native of the San Joaquin Valley, or in your case, the Central Valley, and if not so, from whence do you hail, and what is your family or ancestral connection to agriculture and to the soil and the land?
Well, you know, we are not a family of farmers, but we are definitely have had a long presence in California. My great-great-grandfather was a famous lawyer from San Francisco during the Gold Rush era, was also an ambassador to Japan during the time of Ulysses S. Grant, and so we've had a long family history in San Francisco. My father is a San Franciscan and moved us kids out to Danville back in the 60s and early 70s when it was pretty much
that was a bit of a hinterland in those days.
No, definitely a one-horse town, surrounded by cattle ranches. My mother's from Peru, and she wanted her children to grow up in the country and have horses and pigs and ducks and chickens and all of that. So we kind of had a little, you know, they were all pets. But so we grew up in the country, but we weren't farmers by any means. My father was an engineer.
Gentleman's country.
Yeah, and my husband Eric grew up in Denmark, and he's probably closer to the farming history than I am. His great grandfather and his grandfather both were farmers, so he's probably more connected than I am, actually.
So you're native of the Bay Area, mm-hmm. and your family has a great deal of history there.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume you got an education, went to college. We're going to get around to how you wound up on the land, farming as hard as you did for the last 6 or 8 years. But continue the story. It's most fascinating.
Well,
are you a famous judge, too, and an ambassador to what country?
I'm telling you. I took all the wrong turns, I think, actually. My parents were very passionate about education, and I left college rather early before I finished and started a family and got married and was living in Vallejo, raising my children with Eric, and sort of thought that that was my life. I would be a mom, and I'd work at a winery as a part-time job and raise my children, and I was pretty content with that until I stumbled across this piece of land in Vacaville, and my whole perspective on life and my goals and my work changed completely. So,
what sort of work did your husband do?
Eric is also an engineer, so he wasn't too keen on selling lock, stock, and barrel and moving on to a bare piece of land, but I persuaded him after a couple of years that we should just go for it.
So tell me how this piece of land in Vacaville romanced you. You told me a little bit about that it's in a unique valley, in a unique location.
So Pleasants Valley Road has been a farming community since the 1850s. It's still very much a farming community. And there's a fabulous woman farmer there who has a plant nursery where she propagates and grows 600 varieties of herbs and perennials. And so I had for years driven from Vallejo to Vacaville to buy plants from her because I was an avid gardener. And had always looked at this particular piece of land and admired it. And one day, after about traveling to Vacaville for 4 years to buy gardening material, there was a for sale sign on the piece of property, and that was it. I absolutely knew that Eric and I should buy this piece of land and see what it held for us, what opportunities were there for us. So
you pretty much had to talk him into it.
Yeah, but I'm a good talker when I get going.
So, and what year was this?
I think that was probably around 95, 96. Uh-huh. It took us a couple of years to figure out the financing and what kind of a commitment we wanted to make. I mean, it's 55 acres, and we weren't farmers, and we knew that there was no way we could live there without making a real commitment to something agricultural-based. So it took us a couple of years.
So how did you come up with the concept of what you were going to do with this property? It's well-watered, you said.
Right. So since I had local district water and a great well on the farm, actually it wasn't even a farm then, it was just bare land. And my goal at the time was to have a lavender farm and to plant an olive orchard. I mean, that's really the kind of things I was thinking of, maybe a small vineyard. It's funny now, 15 years later, I'm actually getting around to planting the lavender. You know, best laid plans. The minute we bought that place, every idea we had just kind of went off in a different direction. And, you know, 4 years later, we were a chicken farm.
You got distracted by poultry somehow.
We did. You know,
and how did that come about?
You know, we had some chickens, and I was selling eggs to people in town. It didn't really occur to me that it was a possible business, but I started to hear little rumors from San Francisco that pastured eggs were really important, and people at the farmers market were beginning to ask for them. And
did you read the Pied Piper of pastured poultry, Joel Salatin?
You know, I haven't read that book, and and I didn't even know who he was at the time. I was just kind of going with some gut instincts I had that maybe if people were interested in eggs, maybe there was some little hobby in there for me. I had no ideas of making it a business like it turned out to be. So things started kind of slowly, but took on a life of their own a little bit. Eventually, what the big turning point was when a girlfriend of mine who worked at Chez Panisse came to visit and was cooking up a farm, and took some eggs back to Alice Waters and her chef at the time, Russell and Cal, and cooked them the eggs. And the next day, Jason called and asked if they could buy every egg we had on the farm. So,
and you can't tell Alice no, can you?
I would
never. Nobody can.
She, over the years, became sort of like my guardian angel. She has always done so many kind things for me. Even though she and I don't run into each other very often, she made sure people knew about my farm.
She's a lovely woman.
Yeah, I have a lot to thank her for.
And you also became involved in the slow food movement as well, right?
Well, I had heard about slow food and wanted to be part of it, and called up Chris Carpenter, who was the Convivium leader for the Napa chapter, and I asked if I could join. He told me, no, but you can start your own chapter.
You can start your own club. Join.
Yeah. So I started a chapter in Solano County that I ran for about 2 years, and then I asked my dear friend, Ruth Fidel, to take it over, and she managed it beautifully ever since.
So you built this little flock of chickens up to, from what I understand, until recently, where you were producing about 25,000 meat birds and 10,000 dozen eggs. I don't know if it's about 5 years to get built up to that point. And became quite a tiger if you had by the tail, right?
Yeah, that's a good way of explaining it. It was a bit of a tiger by the tail. it never occurred to me that the farm was going to take off as quickly as it did. I mean, once people tried Dolce Farmers, they got so excited, and then I got excited. So I started raising more hens for more eggs. And we just kind of kept saying yes to everybody. So eventually I had 3,000 laying hens on the farm. And I had developed a big system where there were always baby chicks on the farm. And then I always had layers. And then I always had chickens that were just about to be retired or spent layers and sold as feed chickens. So I had a big rotational system going on the farm. And eventually Alice called me back up and asked me to raise new birds for her, which I agreed to do. And then that was another part of the business that took off as well. So within 3 years of that first request from her, 3 years later, we were raising about 20,000 pastured chickens a year on the farm as well. It was an extraordinary amount of work that if I had realized, I probably would have gone back to my plant lavender. But, you know, it was only Eric and I running the farm.
So your husband abandoned his previous
occupation
and became a full-time farmer with yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So the two of us and...
The two of you mostly managed all the physical labor.
We hand-packed the eggs, we harvested the chickens by hand out in the field at 2 in the morning, and the driver was stocked in at 5 in the morning. We had to get to be processed. So we had some help that came part-time, but basically, you know, as any farmer knows, the burden to keep it going and running is on the farmer. So.
So, because of the pasture orientation that you have and the uniqueness of the product from that perspective, and the fact that you're also raising different breed of birds in the Coney Cornish cross, you chose not to be a certified organic operation, but even in light of that, your products became in great demand. And why did you choose not to be certified organic?
Well, in the beginning, actually, with the very first year I started producing pastured eggs, we did certify them organic and bought organic feed. But as I began to research organic feed, and this was 7 years ago, I became very disillusioned when I realized that so much of the soy and the feed was being brought over from China, South Africa, and Brazil. And I was paying such a huge price for this grain, I thought to myself, why am I feeding local chicken and promoting local food and I'm buying feed that comes from the other side of the world? Did I want to participate in that system? And also whatever other parts of that system existed that I had no control over, like how were workers treated and how is the soil really being cared for.
So even as long as 7 years ago,
yeah,
there was a great deal of imported content,
yeah,
in commercial organic chicken.
Yeah.
I know that's certainly true today, but I didn't know that that was going on there as far back as 7 years ago.
Yeah. So at that point, I decided to take a huge risk, which was to drop the certification and really talk about farming practices and animal husbandry as the primary importance on an animal farm, and then feed to me being third. And so that's how I built the farm, talking about what we did and how we treated our animals, and customers understood. I mean, over the years, I lost a few people who either wanted certified organic fed birds or didn't want birds that had been fed soy, but that was really not the bulk of my business.
We're visiting with Alexis Kilford from Soul Food Farms in Vacaville, and you're listening to Down on the Farm with Tom Lilly, and you're being hosted by KFCF 88.1 Fresno. So, were you able to source then feed from relatively local producers once you gave up the need to search the world for organic sources of feed?
So, this is what we ended up doing. We actually decided to find a local mill and go investigate and see if they would source grains locally. So we went up to Petaluma to Hunt and Barron, and had a long conversation with them, and they talked to us about the commodities market, grain sourcing, how during certain parts of the year they were buying as much grain from California farmers as possible, and during the winter they were probably bringing it in from the Midwest or even Canada. And at that point we had to kind of make a decision, and so we compromised and decided to buy conventional grain from a local mill that was trying to do the best they could with the resources at hand and not buy seed from overseas. Nowadays, 7 years later, there's much more controversy about animal feed. I mean, there's so many things to know, where it's being sourced, is it GMO-free, does it have soy? There's a lot more questions that consumers ask about these things because they're better informed. But nowadays, our little farm just couldn't even afford certified organic feed, even if I wanted to go back to it. So we just kept holding on to the same sort of values that we started the farm with, which is the way we farm and how we treat our animals is the best we can do. And sometimes when you're a small farmer, you have to make compromises. And for us, buying conventional feed from a local mill is the best we can do at the moment.
Well, there's been a lot of challenging things that have occurred and taken place over the last maybe 5 years. In 2008, there was a huge demand and run-up in the price of corn and soybeans, which is responsible to some extent for food riots across the world, and some say was a key to the whole uprising that we call the Arab Spring. And it certainly created a lot of havoc in the world of those feeding animals grains as well in this country. And then more recently, partly because of the horrific drought this year in the Midwest, feed grains also ran up tremendously to twice the cost that we're generally used to paying $4 a bushel for corn in this country, and sometimes even less than that. But currently the price of corn is around $8, and soybeans similar. So even though you have your flock happily out to pasture and eating forage and insects, a chicken's diet cannot be totally grown out there on the pasture, is that right?
Exactly. Chickens, laying hens need a lot of energy to lay those eggs, so they do need to be supplemented with a good laying ration. And meat birds, by virtue of being meat birds, are fast-growing birds. The birds that we raised took 10 weeks to mature from baby chicks, and they need to eat a high-octane feed to build that kind of muscle tissue so that they're ready to harvest at the end of 10 weeks. You know, to put pricing in perspective, conventional feed right now, a 50-pound sack of feed in January cost about $11 to buy for laying hens.
January 2012.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at the end of last month, September, that same sack of feed is costing me $18.85 to buy. And that's just conventional feed. Certified organic feed is about $35 right now for a 50-pound sack. So if you just have a few chickens, you know, that's you can absorb those costs because, you know, you have a few birds in your backyard and you know you're getting good eggs, and you can justify that. But for a small farmer like me, at the end of July, we were spending about $15,000 a month feeding our chickens, but we weren't raising our prices. And when I heard the news about the drought in the Midwest, I kind of saw the writing on the wall at that point. I didn't see how we were going to get through another year of feed cost increases and just philosophically unwilling to raise my prices any further. So, you know,
How were your prices in respect to prices of eggs and chicken in the average supermarket?
Well, pasture chickens and eggs are in some respects, depending on, you know, who you're talking to, considered expensive. I mean, as a farmer, I never thought that I was charging enough because...
You probably weren't. You're not doing that farming anymore.
Yeah, but still, on the consumer side, to see $8 a dozen pastured eggs or to pay $6.50 a pound for a pastured meat chicken is a pretty pricey investment for protein. So,
because what are we used to paying for eggs in a grocery store? $2, $2.50 a dozen, maybe.
Yeah, depending on the grocery store, and maybe $1.79 a pound for chicken.
Uh-huh.
So, pasture poultry farming is much more than just the feed cost, though that's a huge percentage of your inputs. But you know, there's the labor of hand harvesting eggs and chickens, and there's the slaughtering costs when you take meat birds to be processed so that you can sell them at a farmer's market or a store. So, but it came to kind of a turning point, you know, how much more can you charge? You know, I just didn't feel comfortable looking at $9 or $10 a dozen to sell my eggs or $7 or $8 a pound to sell my chickens. We were really moving away from all the reasons why we started farming when Eric and I looked at those kind of charges to our customers. We wanted to feed people, and we knew we couldn't at that level.
Well, so is the whole concept of pastured poultry just a quaint notion that it's nice to think about, but in the age of industrialization, just doesn't make sense anymore? What are the values associated with that production that that people should be encouraged to pay more money for? If they should, or should we just all go back to the grocery store and buy the cheap industrial ones?
Well, absolutely never buy the cheap industrial anything. I think pasture poultry farming has a place, and I think it can be successful. It needs a couple of more rounded out systems that I've kind of come to realize since I've been farming. Pasture poultry farming can be much more successful if it's on a established diversified farm, so you're not just relying on the seasonality of the eggs and the chickens to be the economic driver for your farm. You really need diversity on your farm. I think it's important to think outside of the term of local and really think of regions. How can we build small farms in regions that each farm is supporting each other? I think the other thing that would be a huge benefit to farmers and poultry farmers is to step outside that comfort zone of thinking of sales as competition, but really finding out how to build systems that farmers can share with each other, not only knowledge about animals, but sharing equipment, sharing the distribution costs of moving products to wholesale accounts or farmers markets. It will never be successful, in my mind, farming on any scale, if we're all doing each thing individually and independently and kind of trying to reinvent things on our own. I mean, I really see it as much more successful if we work together.
Well, you actually traveled to Europe, I understand, before you really got deeply involved in this enterprise of yours, and you studied a system that has some of the qualities that you're asking for in France, and it's a system called La Belle Rouge, and it's actually been going on there since shortly after World War II. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and what's going on over there?
So 7 years ago, I went to France to find out how pasture poultry production was being done there, because I had an inkling that it wasn't quite on the small scale that we were experiencing here in the United States. And what I found is that they are actually raising poultry out on pasture and feeding over 1 million people a year these amazing birds. They do it by having a very structured system that's actually overseen by the government, where you have to maintain certain standards. They have people who go out and monitor the farms to make sure the birds are being kept in a certain way and taken care of properly. They have a system set up that are just replicated over and over as far as buildings go and feed goes and management goes. And in that framework, they are able to raise animals out on pasture and feed the country. So it really puts to lie that that idea here in the United States that it's either small farmers or industrialized animal production. I mean, Europe is a good example, especially France, that you can raise animals humanely and with good animal welfare practices and still feed people.
And those chickens that are raised in that manner in the La Belle Rouge system in France, they're not selling as cheaply as the confined animal production over there also, but they find a great deal of support amongst the eating public over there in France, is that right?
That's true. Europeans are very much connected to their culture and their eating traditions, and they expect a certain standard and quality of food in Europe. They're not quite as attached to fast foods as we are here or chain grocery stores. They're still very committed to being connected to where their food comes from. And so I think they pay that prices they do for good food because they know, even without articulating it every day, that they are what they eat. And they expect that when they spend money, they are going to eat the best.
So what are the qualitative differences between industrial raised poultry today Cornish cross couch potato bird versus the kinds of birds and the way that they're raised in either your system or the La Belle Rouge? What are the qualitative differences that people are willing to pay more for?
I think that, first of all, it's sort of once people see what's going on in the industrial animal production system for poultry, and that's made a little bit easier right now with YouTube and all these other kinds of technologies available to actually see what's going on. I think when they see that, they are horrified and they want to find an alternative food source for themselves. When they come over to a small farm and they see people working in the fields, people that they can talk to that actually raised their food. They can see animals running around outside in the sunshine. They can see crops growing in the field. These are the kinds of connections that inspire people, not only to eat better, but to keep alive those farmers in their communities. And it's a slower system. It takes a lot of marketing. It takes a lot of talking. It takes a lot of time to engage people in what you're doing. But it seems to be once they are committed and connected to you, they will, I mean, my experience has been my customers would bend over backwards for Soul Food Farm to make sure we do well and to make sure that they're supporting us in any way they can. Yeah, I mean, the industrial system is so horrible that I think if people understood what they're paying for when they buy cheap meat, they would turn away from it. It's not just the animals are treated badly in confinement, but they're fed foods that are laced with pharmaceuticals. The water needed and that's polluted by raising animals in confinement would be shocking if you actually knew the numbers. So it's not cheap food in the end. And even though it may sound expensive to pay $6 a pound for a chicken, you're actually paying a more true cost for production when you do that.
Yes, a friend of mine that was involved in pastured poultry says cheap food is not good and good food is not cheap.
Yeah, there and, you go.
Many of us are beginning to learn quite a bit about that. I would assume that your customers were deeply disappointed when you told them that you could no longer sustain growing these birds for them. The work was immense and ever there, but the return was just couldn't sustain your operation. Particularly once these feed costs went through the roof.
Yeah, it was definitely a turning point. The feed cost increases and Eric and I being utterly exhausted. But in retrospect, I mean, as two people who were not farmers and didn't come from a farming background, Eric and I really made it up as we went along. looking back now, I see that probably the biggest mistake we made was just not having diversity on our farm. And so those are the things that I think I'm going to step back now and do and add the kind of diversity the farm needs and rethink the idea of what pastured animal farming is going to be.
Well, we're going to be back with you in just a moment. We're going to talk about visioning your future and visioning the future of a better food system for all of us. We're here with Alexis Kofod of Soul Food Farms, and you're listening to Down on the Farm with Tom Willie on KFCF 88.1 FM, and we'll be back in just a few moments after these public service announcements.
The taxes.